This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And Alex Crook from TalkSport.
This week, Match of the Day commentator Guy Mowbray on how he went from working in a brewery, calling in the bailiffs, to commentating on the biggest game in the world.
I had 2 years I was working for John Smith's Brewery in the group debt recovery department, sending out bailiffs to repossess pubs from landlords who hadn't paid for their beer. They offered me a full-time job, actually. But at the same time, I was working every Saturday and a lot of Sundays covering football matches. And the Thursday, Friday, I used to sneak into the computer room at the brewery where nobody else went ever. And I'd make sure all my work was done Monday to Wednesday. So Thursday, Friday, I could go in there and do all my prep for the games for the weekend.
Plus, what Scott Parker said after we'd put the mics down and how Jurgen Klopp made his own self-deprecating weather joke. And I'll tell you why I think VAR made a big mistake this week, but not the one you think.
Find out why I won't be shedding any tears when Huddersfield are dumped out of the Premier League.
And we will also be hearing from Portsmouth News journalist Neil Allen about why supporters still rely on local papers.
All that on the podcast that has staples on speed dial. All football commentators are geeks.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Did you write your own joke there at the end? Because if you did, please don't give up the day job, whatever you do.
That was appalling, isn't it? That was one with you in mind, mate.
It really is appalling, isn't it? It's
like
the worst joke ever. Yeah, of course you don't, because no one ever goes to Staples anymore, because I think it's shut down.
It's in the stationery store.
Yeah.
I get it.
All right, okay. See? Let's just hope that everyone's a little bit brighter than Michelle when they're listening to the podcast. Hey, nice to have you back, by the way, Michelle.
I like the fact you're like, it's nice to have me back. You two were out on the jollies last week while I was working. I did like the fact that you thought I was with Theresa May. I mean, a lot more would have got done if I'd been there. But no, I was actually working. It was you two at Cheltenham. So come on, did you spot any footballers? How much booze did you have? Did you have the VIP treatment? Walking in and say, hey, do you know who I am?
Sam had the VIP treatment. I didn't see any footballers. I did see Dancing on Ice star Brian McFadden, Sam's old mate. And you mentioned footballers at Cheltenham. I did once spend the afternoon there drinking in the Guinness Village with the Bristol City team, who helped convince a couple of girls that my mate Jake was an Israeli international who played for them. That was quite...
I thought he was going to make a joke then about that. I didn't see any footballers, but I did see the Bristol City team. And I thought that was a bit harsh. But luckily, he didn't go down that avenue. Did you, when you saw them, did you give them any winners? Because, you know, I know you did this wonderful tipping service on Twitter this week. Because apparently now, Michelle, he's a horse racing geek as well. However,
flat cap.
He gave up on the first day, or he deleted his tweets because only Tuesdays is still there. I've gone back and had a look. And it's not a great advert. One winner from seven tips, and they were all one or two in the betting. So he's about as much of a racing geek as he is a football geek. Although, actually, he does do a bit more prep for the racing, to be fair.
Do you know what? I actually... did keep doing those tips, so you're obviously looking in the wrong place. I had about 8 or 9 winners, and I had a 25-1 second in the Gold Cup, so I'll take that.
Brilliant. 8 or 9 winners from about 116 bets. Well done. Now, we didn't want you, Michelle, in particular, to miss out on the language of love last week, so last week we left it out. This week, though, we have a word that might have been used at your game, Crook, for Javier Hernandez, or at my game for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer back in the day. Here's a test for you. Where did the phrase super sub come from? Have a think. See if you can work it out. And then we'll talk about it a little bit later in the programme.
Okay,
Sam, we'll have the answer to that a bit later on. But now it's time to look back at the weekend in numbers.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
James Milner's late penalty against Fulham put Liverpool back on top of the table. Milner is now unbeaten in the 51 Premier League games he scored in.
Chelsea's top four hopes suffered another setback as they lost to Everton. Only relegation-haunted Fulham have registered more away defeats this season. Ouch.
Brighton will face Manchester City in the FA Cup semi-final after their dramatic penalty shootout win over Millwall. The last time they met in the competition was when the Seagulls reached the final in 1983.
Huddersfield managed 3 goals in a Premier League game for only the 4th time. but they still lost at West Ham.
City came from behind to see off Swansea, the first time Pep Guardiola's men have conceded the opening goal in a match for 24 games.
Joshua King's double in Bournemouth's 2-2 draw at West Ham saw him become the second highest scoring Norwegian in Premier League history, behind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, of course.
He's still a fair few behind Solskjaer, though. So those are the numbers behind the weekend's main talking points. But what else did we learn?
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
Yes, I was at Craven Cottage for Liverpool's late win over Fulham, and afterwards spoke to both managers. Interestingly, Klopp was so delighted at getting the 3 points. He was joking, he was giggling, he was making fun. He was like, yeah, we're top of the table, it's cool. What happened was Liverpool were totally in control of the game, so in control of the game that I think that Van Dijk and Alisson fell asleep. I think that was the problem. I thought they just wanted to liven things up because it was getting pretty boring, and Fulham didn't really have a chance in the game up until that point. And then they got themselves in a little tangle, and they were 15 minutes away from drawing that game against comfortably the second worst team in the league. But no wonder he was chirpy, Jurgen Klopp, because he'd just been given an absolute gift from Sergio Rico, one of three goalkeepers who at one point this season have been the Fulham number one. He made a severe error of judgment and Liverpool won. So he was jolly, very jolly. And I knew from the very start, you know what it's like when you're doing an interview with someone, that you know within a couple of syllables whether or not it's going to be a good interview or a difficult one. And this was going to be a great one, because as soon as I said, hello, a win is a win, but he went, yes. And as soon as he made that little sort of sound, I thought, Elliot, we're in here. We're going to have some fun with this. And I can ask him whatever I like. He even made a little joke about the wind. Like, you know, we always have a go at him because he makes these excuses and everyone says, oh, you know, like, he doesn't like the wind, blah, blah. He actually said to me, I can't say it, so you better say it. And I said, okay, the wind was bad. He went, yeah, he said it, not me. And it was like all very funny and all very jolly. At the other end of the scale, Scott Parker, who's basically said to me, yeah, it's impossible now for them to stay up. He said, it's a massive mountain for us to climb to stay up. But he was really funny, actually, afterwards. I know him quite well. We've worked together a bit. He's very personable. He's a great lad. I said to him, are you enjoying it? Are you getting on okay? He said, yeah, he is enjoying it and he likes being the decision maker, but he is fed up to the back teeth of the word Scott. He said, all I hear all day is, Scott, can you look at Scott? What do you think about Scott? Can you just, let's just ask Scott. Scott, can we have Scott? Is there a... He said, if I got a quid every time someone said bloody Scott, I wouldn't be worrying about staying in a job, that's for sure.
Do you think he's getting fed up of it already?
No, he said it with a smile on his face. He's a good lad. I hope he's got a big
really
future
nice
in
lad.
It. He is. And I actually think he's... A lot of people think he's a bit too quiet to be a manager. But he's got steel there. And he's very good at communicating. And I think, actually, you know, they kept the score down against Liverpool. They didn't do much in terms of offensive work yesterday in that game against Liverpool. But certainly, they looked a lot more organised and a lot more, the attitude seems a lot better since he took over as the manager. So good luck to him. I like him, and I think it's great that a young English coach is getting the opportunity at a team like Fulham.
Over £110 million, that's what they spent, and they're going down. Mad.
Yeah, but they spent it badly, didn't they? They spent it like crook on a night out. Like, just whatever.
Or horses.
Give me whatever.
Crook
just give
horses.
Me whatever. I'll have some of that. So, yeah, exactly. They spent it like crook on betting, yeah.
You're right about Scott Parker, though. He is a great bloke. I remember interviewing Harry Arter when he was at Bournemouth once, and he's actually Scott Parker's brother-in-law. And as we all know, Harry Arter was bombed out by Charlton playing non-league football for Woking, and he was on the verge of giving up the game. And Scott Parker was so adamant that he shouldn't do that, that he topped up his non-league wages so that he was still effectively earning a professional wage. He would get him to do odd jobs like mow the lawn and wash his car, just so that he didn't give up on that dream. And here he is now, Harry Arter, making a very good living as a Premier League player. It wouldn't have happened without Scott Parker. I think really that epitomises him as a bloke.
I just hope that he does very well as a manager and a coach as well. Good luck to him. You did have a bit of a tough time, though, didn't you? You yourself down at the London Stadium with Huddersfield's shirt numbers. You couldn't see them. Do you need glasses, binoculars? What can we do for you to help you out here?
Do you know what? I might invest in a pair of binoculars. I think you need them at the London Stadium at the best of times. You definitely needed them on Saturday. I knew this was going to be a problem. I was talking to one of the TV commentators before the game. And once we both realised they were going to be playing in blue and white stripes with black numbers, we were worried because, as we've mentioned this podcast before, the press box is so far away from the pitch at the London Stadium. You may as well be watching from the car park or even from Westfield Shopping Centre. So to try and identify the Huddersfield players from a distance was a big issue. And the TV commentator actually said, you'll notice in my commentary tonight, I'm not going to identify the players unless I'm 100% sure. So when a goal goes in, there will be a few seconds pause while I work out who scored it. Now, you can do that in TV. Less easy to do on radio. Luckily, we had 7 goals and I called them all correctly. But listen, if Huddersfield go down, they deserve it for those shirts.
You did take 7 minutes to get one of those goal scorers, though, didn't you? You gave yourself a bit of room, didn't you?
A little bit of breathing space. That was actually on the West Ham goal for Ogbonna.
He wasn't wearing a Huddersfield shirt.
But honestly, that press box there is terrible. I despise the London Stadium. It takes you 4 hours to get from the tube station into the ground. It takes you 4 hours to get in the press box. It takes you 4 hours to get back down again. It is hideous.
Oh, poor
It's a hard life, isn't it, Crook? You know, Premier League, you have those monitors where when I go and watch Cheltenham, you can't see their numbers either.
Yeah.
No replays there.
Yeah. You don't hear Michelle moaning, do you?
I think you do. She moaned about shirt numbers in the very first podcast, to be fair.
I might have done this.
And you had a good week, didn't you? You hooked up with a couple of legends in Martin O'Neill at Forest, Sol Campbell at Yeovil.
Yeah. Oh, Martin O'Neill. Never interviewed him, so I was like, oh, what's he going to be like? Because you hear all sorts of stories about what people are like. But he was really lovely and sort of my other half was like, oh, I just saw your interviews go out on Sky Sports News. Martin O'Neill's very nice, isn't he? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, he was just really polite about your questions and things, because he'd be like, I take your point, and like be like that. And he's really softly spoken, and I just wasn't expecting
what accent was that?
I'm trying Dad to work out
Irish.
Myself.
Hello there.
You doing a Cornish accent there? Sorry.
And
he's great company. He's great company, Martin.
Yeah,
O'Neill.
He's really,
very funny,
really
man.
Great. And I've always wondered what he's like to work with as a pundit and things like that. And just from sort of 4 or 5 minutes with him, he seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
And did lots of managers. Was it sort of 4 or 5 games in a week? The last one I did was like huge game at the bottom of the Football League, Yeovil Town and Macclesfield. You think one of them is probably going to be relegated, won't be in the Football League next year. Didn't have to do post-match from this one, but Sol Campbell was there, saw him from a distance, and that's as close as I got.
Oh, that's probably good, really, because he can be quite, he's quite difficult to talk to at the best of
times.
Have
you guys done post-match with him?
I did him when he first signed for Portsmouth, and he was just a tricky interview. I mean, I think he's quite a bright guy. He's a very intelligent guy, Sol. Mm. But I think he knows it, and he keeps you on your toes. I asked him a question. I asked a couple of questions, and he gave me very quick, short answers. It was the day he signed for Portsmouth. Harry Redknapp had taken him to a pie and mash shop to get him to sign. They both come up with that great story. Whether or not it was true or not, I'm still not sure. Yeah, he was a bit tricky. I think the boys who were down in Portsmouth with him found him a bit tricky as well. But I think he's much better. I think he's done much better as a manager than many people thought he would. I know they're still struggling to stay in the division, but they had no hope, did they, when he took over? So
no.
You never know.
No,
good luck
big,
to him.
Big win. Big
I think Michel got as close to him as any of his Portsmouth teammates did, because he had this rule, didn't he, that he wouldn't let any of his teammates sit next to him on the plane for away games.
No way.
Even though he was club captain at the time.
There's a load of Sol Campbell Portsmouth stories, but we'll save them for a different day, I think. We have got someone from Portsmouth coming on the programme a little bit later on to talk about local papers, and we're going to speak to Guy Mowbray in the next few minutes as well. But first of all, VAR made the headlines again this weekend. I know that this is going to go on for ages because you two are going to start moaning, but it's actually nonsense. Because you're all whinging about the fact that there wasn't VAR at Swansea. Correct? Am I wrong here?
No, 100%. Spot on.
There should have been VAR there, yeah.
Okay, so here's the bare facts of the story. 2 seasons ago, the stakeholders, the clubs, the officials, the supporters, nominally, they would have asked some supporters groups, say, we want VAR. The Premier League say, okay, but we want to trial it first before we implement it. The FA say, we'll trial it. And the EFL say, we'll trial it in the Carabao Cup. The FA say, well, we can't put it in every ground in the FA Cup because, you know, there's about 200 teams that take part in the FA Cup. So we'll have to limit it in some way. So what we'll do is we'll have a rule where we only do it at Premier League grounds, okay? And the EFL Cup games, oh, yeah, we'll do the same thing. 1 year later, people moan because this trial that you asked for and you wanted before you put it into regular action in the Premier League, that at an FA Cup ground where something didn't quite work for some set of fans, there wasn't VAR involved in this particular match. Well, it wasn't there because it's not a Premier League ground. It wasn't there because that was a decision that was made a long time ago. How you are surprised about this, I don't know, because it's not as if it was a secret. It was always going to be the case, and it's only because something has gone wrong that everybody's moaning about. It is not a disgrace. Wow. It is not out of order. It is a process. It is what everybody should have known was going to happen. We're at the end of that process now. The trial is over, so no. Next season it will be different. Yes, I think no. that from now on, I think it should just be that we only have it from the quarterfinals on because everybody should have the same treatment. But it is a trial, and that is what they decided to do.
At what point do they decide to trial it in a massive competition? At what point can that be a trial? They've used it in the World Cup.
They decided 2 years ago they're going to use it in the FA Cup and the EFL Cup before bringing it into the Premier League.
I know, but why use them as a trial? I just don't think you can trial something.
Where else are you
going to
trial it?
That's a fair point. But
the Dutch Eredivisie trialed it in their division for the IFAB. Yeah. The MLS trialed it in their division for the IFAB.
That's what the Premier League should have done.
The Premier League thought it was a bigger product than that and decided that it would like it if its domestic cup competitions would trial it for it first.
They did trial it.
The Premier League should have had it first.
They did trial it in an under-23 game involving Swansea, ironically. In fact, the Liberty Stadium was the first ground to trial the VAR system back in October of 2017. I just think that just adds insult to injury. They have the ability. They have the technology.
But they had.
It should have been used across the board.
They had. That was 2 years ago.
Sam, in the quarterfinals, like you said, in the quarterfinals, how can they? Like, did someone not think of this in the quarterfinals?
I agree with
you.
I think going forward, we have learnt from this trial that in cup competitions, it needs to be standardised in order for it to be fair. I'm with you. But it shouldn't have been a surprise to you or anybody else that there wasn't VAR at Swansea on Saturday night. It shouldn't have been a surprise to you.
It wasn't a surprise. It's just not right. I just don't think it's right. It's the fact that they've thought that it's the quarterfinal of supposedly one of England's biggest competitions and they don't think VAR should be used in some games, but it should be used in others. They should have thought, right, when we get to the quarterfinals, we probably should implement it at all grounds by then.
Totally, and they will do next season.
They haven't had that foresight, you know. Oh, I don't know.
Well, they did have the... They will have the foresight, but this is a trial. And this is the problem that I think people have got. One, lots of people don't know how VAR works. Two, they don't understand that this is a trial. From next season, it'll be in the Premier League, and you won't have a game, not one game, without it. If that was the case, then that would be a disgrace. But it isn't, because that's not what's going to happen. In order to get things right, there are going to be teething problems and issues, and you're going to have to react to those.
Yeah.
But it is not what I heard somebody say at the weekend. It's a disgrace. It's a total out of order. You know, it's nonsense. It is not a disgrace. You knew it was going to happen. All the managers knew it was going to be like this. All of the officials knew it was going to be like this. It is not a surprise. But this
the
is
only thing-
what... Go on.
Go on. The only thing I'd say is, why is it good enough to use in the World Cup, the biggest competition in the world of football, yet the FA don't think we can use it properly here yet? Why was it still going to be a trial after the World Cup?
Okay, because we don't have the equipment in the stadiums that the World Cup venues do. World Cup venues are unbelievably well-resourced in terms of data, in terms of cameras, in terms of facilities for the press, for the public, and the communication skills of the broadcast systems within the ground. So, for example, the big screens can communicate in certain ways, which not all of our grounds can do. You don't even have them at Old Trafford and at Anfield. For example, the commentator information system, I think I've referred to before, is not in place in the Premier League. So
they've got WhatsApp, and they can use WhatsApp.
They've got WhatsApp, and they do use WhatsApp, but that isn't exactly the most professional way to explain it to broadcasters, or to you can't WhatsApp the entire stadium, can you? You can't walk up to a game and just join a WhatsApp group.
Have you got shares in VAR, by the way? Because you are the biggest advocate of VAR I think I've ever met. Like, you won't say one negative thing about VAR. You are
incorrect.
Completely in the pro camp.
Incorrect, and here we go, because VAR did make the headlines this weekend for what you're talking about, but I wanted to talk about something different, and that was Victor Lindelof's red card for his over-the-top challenge on Diego Jota, which was overturned, but it shouldn't have been. That was a mistake by VAR. Only if it is a clear and obvious error should it have been overturned, and I don't think it was clear or obvious. I understand that the referees don't think that it should have been overturned either. The law states excessive force or endangering the safety of an opponent would deem a red card. And that is if you far exceed the necessary use of force or you're in danger of injuring an opponent, which I think, when you look at it, Lindelof was. Now, one big issue is that Nuno Espirito Santo and his entire coaching staff jumped up like banshees screaming for a red card right at the moment of impact, which I think sort of just took everybody by a bit of a surprise. But if you look at it, the considerations are the speed and intensity, if there was any malice involved, and what are the chances of playing the ball? Now, to me, I think that deserved an orange card. So it was a mix between a yellow and a red. It was a strong yellow and a red. There's no such thing as an orange. So therefore, the point is, it could have been given either way. It's not a clear and obvious error. And Martin Atkinson's initial decision, he was closest to it. And Simon Long, who was the man who was standing on the near touchline, he thought it was a red and he was very close to it. He would have communicated that to Atkinson. That was a red card. And I don't think Chris Kavanagh had the right to overturn it.
It made the referee look a bit foolish, didn't it? It made him look a bit of a mug.
Yeah, it did.
It was, you know, when you've shown a red card and then someone in your ear basically tells you to reduce it to a yellow in front of how many people in the stadium? 35,000 people?
31,000, yeah.
He can't have been feeling too good about himself. No, but I didn't think it was a red card, I've got to be honest.
I thought it was.
Yeah, I think it was a red card. I would have given a red card for it. And I think the fact that those two guys, Martin and Simon, were so close to it, they would have seen the speed and the intensity of that challenge. I think when you're watching it back, and they watched it in slow motion, which I thought, you're not really supposed to do that, I don't think, for a red card, because you've got to understand the velocity of the decision. I thought, yeah, he's going to overturn it. The interesting thing is the referee didn't go and have a look at the monitor because he trusted Chris Kavanagh had made the right decision. I think when they have their debrief and look back at that, they will question that fact, that why he was so insistent that it was overturned. And I think in the future, maybe if I was Martin Atkinson, I might be looking at a monitor if someone tells me I've got to overturn a decision, because I don't think that should have been overturned.
Can I make a quick prediction?
Go for it.
That next season, when we're recording this podcast, every week we're going to be talking about VAR. In some guys or
maybe
another.
We talk about referees, so what's the difference? The bare facts are 96% the more I of see decisions of it, made by a referee are correct. When you have VAR, it goes to 99. What's the problem?
See, I liked it at the World Cup. I was against it before the World Cup. I warmed to it at the World Cup, but the more I see and the more I read, I don't like it. Michelle?
I love it. I think we should have it. But I think that they need to... I think what happened at the weekend was a bit weird, because he didn't see the replay of the incident himself, did he? He had to refer that to the guys in the van, as it was. So I think that needs to be tidied up a bit. But for offsides...
Well, he did that because he trusted the judgment of the person in his ear. And I think in going forward, he might go and look at a monitor as a result of that.
Yeah.
Which will slow down the process.
Are they still allowed to do that?
Yeah, because they are allowed to do that.
I thought the FA didn't particularly want them doing that. They wanted the guy watching in the VAR headquarters to be the man who made the final decision.
Which is a big difference from the way UEFA do it. UEFA want the referee to be the man who makes the final decision, whereas the Premier League want to keep the speed of the game going, so they want you to trust who is in your ear.
Which I'm in favour of, because, listen, we want to get home for our takeaway on a Saturday night. We don't want to be there for 3 hours.
You want to get home for your takeaway.
You're listening to the All Football Commentators and Geeks podcast. Next, Sam will be chatting to Match of the Day commentator Guy Mowbray.
Shots on a Friday.
Back in the net.
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the Championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Guy Mowbray was the sound of my pain on Saturday night as he commentated on Manchester United's turgid performance at Wolves, but not before being grilled by Sam.
So I'm delighted to say we've got Guy Mowbray from the BBC with us for today's edition of the podcast. All football commentators are geeks, but you're not having that, are you?
Of course not. That's a ridiculous thing to say.
Why?
We're not geeks. What's wrong with numbers?
I just like numbers. It's not geeky.
Are you a rock star commentator? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Well, I think we've all got a bit of that in us, haven't we? You certainly have. No, we've all got a bit of that in us. We all like to think we are. No, I'm not having this geek's life.
Okay. How did it all start for you? Because, of course, it's a long old journey, isn't it?
It
you
is.
Know,
yeah. It's gone by in a flash, though.
But it only seems like yesterday, I reckon, that you were starting out.
I think we all have different routes in as well, don't we? It's not... I have a bit of a rule of thumb on how I judge people. If you grow up wanting to be a football commentator, that should bar you from ever being one.
Right, okay.
It should happen by accident. It has to happen by accident.
Right.
And I think for me, I think there's a few of us in this position, I just wanted to play. That's all I ever did. It's all I ever knew. It's my only interest, football and cricket, really, and a bit of golf growing up. That was kind of it. Just a sports mad, played everything. And I think I was probably average at everything without shining at anything. And yeah, it wasn't until I was about sort of... I think I was about 20, 21, and it was actually a line from my dad that got me into this, because he was a PE teacher, he was a qualified coach, and it was one day I was at home in the garden, I was in between jobs, shall we say, and he just said, "What are you going to do with your life?" And it was as blunt as that, and I sort of didn't really answer, and he said, "Look, you're not going to play football. It's not going to happen." And it was the first time really, like, I suppose not really. But then he said, "You know, there's plenty of other career opportunities in football if that's what you're determined to do." And that was it. I put all my focus into writing letters, before email, writing letters and just seeing if I could get a foot through the door. And that was it. And like many of us, for 2-3 years, pretty much worked unpaid as a hobby at a weekend before getting a break. And then things started to happen.
Who gave you your big break?
It's the Club Call Network. Before the internet, where people used to ring up their clubs and get information on the team, the official club call. Every football league club and some non-league clubs had a club call line, and I did it locally. I did York City, I did Hull City, I did Leeds United, and that was my break. And from there, local radio stations would say, "Oh, we're not sending next week, would you mind covering it for us as well?" And that's how things started to grow. But I say to a lot of people trying to get into it now, you've got to be prepared to class it as a hobby. If anything develops from it, great. Class it as a hobby. I had 2 years I was working for John Smith's Brewery in the group debt recovery department, sending out bailiffs to repossess pubs from landlords who hadn't paid for their beer. They offered me a full-time job, actually, but at the same time I was working every Saturday and a lot of Sundays covering football matches. And the Thursday, Friday, I used to sneak into the computer room at the brewery where nobody else went ever. And I'd make sure all my work was done Monday to Wednesday, so Thursday, Friday, I could go in there and do all my prep for the games for the weekend. And they thought I was working out who owed what for their beer. I wasn't. I was looking at Hull City's performance over the last few weeks.
You worked on ITV when they had the Premier League for that short period of time.
Yeah. I was there 5 years.
And then you went to the BBC when Match of the Day got it back again. Yeah. Was that a difficult decision for you, or was it pretty simple?
No, because my contract was up and they were getting rid of me. So it was horrible, actually, because European Championships were on 2004, which I was contracted for. And I got a phone call to tell me that I hadn't had any word about my contract. I assumed, because I joined before they had Premier League highlights, or Premiership as it was for that very brief period. So I assumed it would be back to Champions League and a bit of Central Soccer Special, bit of this, that and the other, some regional stuff. But then I got a call before the Euros, basically for my schedule for the Euros. And they said, "The good news is, right, have you got your diary?" I said, "Yep." I said, "Holland v Latvia in Braga, that's on June the whatever it was." I went, "Okay, put that down, it's live on ITV2. COCOM to be confirmed, okay. Bad news is, that's it, that's all you're doing." I went, "What?" "Yeah, you'll be in London on standby in case the line goes down," which it never does, as we know.
Yeah.
So that was it, my tournament was spent in London, bar 1 2-day trip to Portugal. When I was actually that embarrassed that I didn't want to see anybody. I did the game, I went back to my room. I knew everybody was down in the bar, I just didn't want to see anybody. I was embarrassed, I thought I was finished. I really did. I had no job to come back to. And Paul Armstrong then got talking to me from the BBC and said, "Look, we're going to be sending commentators to every game. So come and join us."
Wow.
And nobody to this day ever rung me from ITV to say, "Oh, by the way, your contract's up, we're not renewing it." That was it. Which is Euro 2004 finished and I was out the door.
That is an amazing, really, isn't it? It's a great story, because in a sense, because despite that feeling that you must have had, like you said, going back to your room, being depressed about the fact that you didn't know what was going to happen. But then all of a sudden you find yourself, 5-10 years later, whenever it is, you're doing the World Cup final for BBC One.
Yeah.
To the massive, big audience.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it's strange how things work, isn't it? think I've always had confidence in my ability to do it, but there was a lot of people doing it, as there are now, and it was a hell of a queue to get through, and I was kind of third choice, fourth choice, I suppose, at ITV. And looking back, there just wasn't the work. It just would have been nice for somebody to tell me, that, look, we're not renewing your contract, look for other avenues, because I didn't know, I was naive. I was what? How old was I then? 32? Maybe I should have known better, but I kind of just assumed something would happen, and it never did. So anyway, that's how it
works.
We're
a lot nicer on ITV now.
No, that's how it works. That's it's grown up, isn't it? Toughens you up.
Yeah. Obviously, you've worked at the BBC now for a long time, and you established yourself as the man who does all the big finals now, touch wood. when you realised that you'd become that man...
I still haven't realised it.
What was your first thought, though, when you got the call to say you're doing the World Cup final?
It was 2010 South Africa, and the hint was the League Cup final a few months earlier, at the end of February. Man United Villa, I think it was that year. Can't remember totally. I think it was that year. I don't know about you, but you know, some of our colleagues can remember everything about every game they've ever been to. I can't. Once it's done, I'm on to the next, and yeah. I can't. And
short-term
half
memory.
I think, was I there? So that's, yeah. Anyway, I did the League
I've
Cup
I've been
final.
There, I've done that. I've seen reruns of games and thought,
and
I think I commentated on that.
Some of our colleagues are incredible, aren't they? Now, they're the geeks.
Yeah, we're the rock stars,
yeah, absolutely.
Honestly.
No, I got sort of that was the hint, I suppose. But again, nothing was told to us until practically the eve of the World Cup.
Yeah.
Sort of the first time it sort of sunk
sorry,
in.
Sorry, Sags is just coming in halfway through our interview. It's okay. Nice to see you. Okay.
Very nice to see you.
We're just doing an interview for a podcast. It's lovely to see you.
No. You look nice. More the merrier. Join in.
It is. Yeah.
Less of the geeks. Oh, good. I'm not having this geek. Anyway. Not geek. Yeah, and the first I saw when it sort of sunk in a little bit was Henry Winter wanting to interview me before a Chelsea game. And he called me and we had a bit of lunch, and sort of that was my first sort of interview. You're doing the World Cup final for the BBC. And yeah, I suppose I am, yeah. Even then, actually, you know, it was a little bit premature, that, because if I'd had a shocker in the group stage and got everything wrong, I don't think they'd have had any hesitation in putting somebody else on it. So, yeah, it's never a given. You've got to perform like anything else, haven't you?
Wollstoneholm, Coleman, Motson, and
you.
Know,
these are not things I think about.
That's
honestly,
it.
These are not things I think about. Oh, Barry Davies did one.
One.
Yeah, Barry Davies did one. But three in a row now, so I'm hopefully. I don't think anybody's done four in a row. Somebody told me nobody's done four in a row.
Oh, really?
I've got to keep my game in order. I don't know that. You know, honestly, these aren't things I particularly worry about, honestly. It's just, you've just got...
You hope you get another game after you've done the last one.
Let's do cliches. It is. You're only as good as your last game.
We all feel the same way.
Yeah.
Who do you enjoy working with the most? I mean, how hard is it working with Keown for us?
It's impossible.
He's already been giving us stick just sitting here.
It's impossible. Here. No, he's great. I love touring about with Martin as well. He's a great companion to have on tour. But we've got some good guys, co-coms. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, I don't think I've ever not got on with any co-com I've ever worked with. Actually, can I just put something to bed?
Yeah.
There's something that crops up every now and again, which really irritates the hell out of me. And it goes back to that World Cup in 2010. And people ask me about it occasionally, about me and Laura. And there's something online about, you can see, the spat. It's never happened. It's a myth. It never happened. And there's this argument we had on air. And they don't like each other. It's absolute nonsense. I've never gotten better with anybody. He's the best, as far as I'm concerned. Don't tell Martin. But you know, he is. I love Laura to pieces. We had a whale of a time.
Did someone just take
been.
That out of context?
You know what it is? What happened was, I dropped my pen. Literally, simple as dropped my pen.
Yeah.
And as I bent down to get my pen, we were behind a desk in, I think it was in Bloemfontein. As I went down, I went like that, and my knee came up and smacked the desk right on the knee bone. And I just went, and I was close to swearing. Laura goes, "You all right?" Like that, in his dry way.
Yeah.
And I sort of went, "Fine, thanks." Because I was absolutely in agony.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I was close, to, very close to being sacked, because I'd have come out with all sorts. The F's and C's and the works. And that was it. And they don't get on. Listen to how frosty it is. It's nonsense. And they don't understand that there's a lot of piss-taking goes on.
Yeah.
On air and off air, and it's just an extension of it.
I love that when you're working with a commentator. It's so strange, isn't it? Because you're standing next to someone who you're doing the co-commentary with, sometimes you can be laughing together about
Absolutely.
Something that is happening or has happened previously.
Yeah.
and the listener or the audience
totally misinterpret it.
Completely either takes it wrong or doesn't understand it.
They don't understand. Maybe we shouldn't do it. Maybe we shouldn't engage in this banter. But you know what? It's let's face it, they're all ex-players. They're used to it. Yeah. I work with Savage, for God's sake. It's hilarious.
I work with Colin
Moore. He just can't stop himself. He's brilliant. He's like a big kid. He's never grown up.
We once had we did a Marseille versus Manchester United game in which Rod Fanny was playing. And I said that Wayne Rooney had come inside Rod Fanny. But I missed out the Rod bit. And yeah, he was gone. He was on the floor.
I had a similar one. Working for Metro Radio a few years ago, doing a Sunderland game away to Crewe with Eric Gates, who we just could not get past Kenny Lunt and Marcus Bignot. and the game was another highlight of that game. It was an eventful night, that. Robbie Savage had just left Crewe to join Leicester, and he was back watching his old mates at Crewe. And he had a pair of leather trousers on. I've never actually spoken to Robbie about this. I have to verify this. My memory tells me this happened. And we used to have a roving reporter, Gilly, Guy Gilly and Gatesy on Metro Radio. Very popular, very, very, very good show that was. The thing I'm most proud of still to this day is that program.
Really?
Without a doubt. I miss it dreadfully.
I think we all feel that about our local radio stations.
And Gilly used to go off. We used to send him off with a tape or recorder, a mini disc recorder at half time, and he'd go and find somebody, sometimes a player, sometimes a fan, sometimes just a steward, and he'd do like a silly 2-3 minute interview. He came back for the Crewe game at half time, just saying that I was about to start, and said, oh, just time to hear from Gilly, I'm plugging it in. I didn't have time to veto it and listen to what he'd done. So I played it, and he went, yes, thank you, guy, here we are. I've been joined by Barry Gibb from the Bee Gees. At which point, Sav then just walked off. And I'm like, is that it? Was that it?
Anyway, you then have to go back and describe what Sav was wearing.
Yeah, you had
wearing.
To be there. Yeah. Anyway,
I wonder if he used talcum times. Powder to get into those leather
He'll
trousers.
He'll deny it.
Yeah, of course he will. Obviously, you've worked in radio and television. Do you still, every now and again, dabble in a bit of radio?
Not as much as I'd like to.
You've done a bit from Five Live, though, haven't you?
Yeah, a little bit. They don't call me very often. No, they've got their own guys, haven't they? So they've got a great team of commentators. Fantastic.
Do you like it?
I do. I love it. I love both though.
Yeah.
And actually, when I started at Eurosport, my first television commentaries was whilst I was working for Metro Radio. So I would do, say, two television commentaries in the week, then at the weekend have to do at least one, maybe two radio commentaries.
Yeah.
And I found that kept me really sharp.
Yeah.
Because I had to think, what am I, you do that now, don't you? You have to think, what am I on today? Hang on. And you do. It's a totally different style. Totally different style. It should be.
I like the difference between the two.
Yeah, I do.
I find sometimes when I come back from a tournament, though, if I've been doing television for a long, so that sometimes in the summer, I've done 8 weeks of television, so warm-up games, then a tournament, then come back, and I go into the Charity Shield, and there's a point in like 22 minutes into the Charity Shield where I have to kick myself and say, keep talking.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Don't let the pitches breathe today.
I find that after every summer. I'm not doing anything in theory this coming summer, so I'm already thinking, God, I'll be rusty in August, and I will. First three or four, what do I do? How do I do it? I've forgotten. It's not like riding a bike. It takes a little bit of time to get back in a groove, if you like.
Yeah, but it is a great job, and we're very lucky to do it.
It's a brilliant job.
And if you have to go back and look at any game and any moment, what would be your highlight? Is it the Aguero moment? Is it an England moment at
no,
the World
that's,
Cup?
That's my. I hate that commentary.
What, the Aguero?
Yeah, I hate it.
We all done it, but I mine's. It's the worst one for me. I wish I'd. Yeah, well,
I just wish I'd done it better.
But we're always.
I think that for every commentary I've ever done, I wish I'd done it better.
We're always thinking that.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing and an easy thing, isn't it?
What's your best one? What's your moment that sticks out?
Nothing I've done. Really dull like that. No, nothing. It's games. Games rather than anything I've ever said. I don't listen back to commentaries. I don't do that.
Do you not?
No, I don't do that. You're probably the same as well. I have a rule as well, which works all the time. The 1 in 10 commentaries I go back home thinking I've had a good day today. That was really good. Mm-hmm. I'll watch it, maybe watch Match of the Day that night, and I'll think, oh, no, it's not. It's shocking. 9 times out of 10, I go home thinking, that was awful. God, I made a right mess of that. Watch Match of the Day. Oh, that was really good. And that happens all the time. So you think you're your own good judge, maybe you're not, I don't know. The game that always stands out for me, because it's the game really that gave me everything and got me my next break, would be the playoff final in 98, Charlton Sunderland.
Oh, wow, what a
still,
game.
It's still my favourite game. The whole weekend, we were covering it for Sunderland. Yeah, as you know, local radio, if you're doing it for that, you have a bias. You do, because you know your audiences, so you're broadcasting to. And What a season. What a game. Even the end. I wouldn't change the end. Mickey Gray might.
Yeah, Mickey Gray would.
Oh, Mickey's great. I love Mickey to bits. I've had some excellent escapades with him over the years. And I wouldn't change it. I really wouldn't. And what a game. What a weekend. There's one story. The Checkatrade Trophy final coming up. There's one story that I remember vividly. We're all in the fountain the night before. Everybody's been out all afternoon. Punch and Judy pub, Covent Garden, and into Trafalgar Square. Everybody's in the fountain. I was soaked, I was drenched. I remember standing on the edge of the fountain, an American tourist came up and said, "Which team is this?" I said, "It's Sunderland, northeast of England." He said, "You guys must have played a hell of a game today." I said, "Game's tomorrow, mate." And his face, he just couldn't comprehend this invasion that was happening. And it'll happen again, March the 31st.
It will. I'm doing that game. It should be fun.
I'll be there.
Good luck. Listen, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Great to see you.
Appreciate it.
Great to see you.
Cheers.
Brilliant stories from Guy Mowbray. It just shows you the ups and downs of a commentator's career or anyone's career and how things, you know, can always turn very quickly for you. You know, he went from being dumped by one organisation to doing the biggest match in the world for BBC One in 6 years, which is amazing, really.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. On Match of the Day, him and Steve Austin are my faves. And yeah, I think everyone has to make certain adjustments and sacrifices, and listening to his there, I mean, it's just got an image of him sitting in the back, aren't you? Getting his prep done, and fantastic, and obviously now one of the world's best.
Yeah, he's got a great turn of phrase as well, hasn't he? Really has.
He uses words very well. So that was Guy Mowbray, and still to come, we'll be hearing from local newspaper hack Neil Allen.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Now, much of our chat focuses on the way football is covered in the national media, be it TV, radio or papers. But of course, a great number of fans still rely on their local outlets as the main source of news on their beloved clubs. One man who does a sterling job on that front is Neil Allen from the Portsmouth News, who gave a very impassioned speech on the importance of local newspapers when he won an award recently and the role they have to play in an increasingly shrinking market. So we sent Sam to the South Coast to get more on the subject.
I'm delighted to say one of our old colleagues, Neil Allen, has met me in a pub in Southsea in Portsmouth just to talk about local journalism, local newspapers, local radio. You and I worked on a patch down here together many years ago now. It feels like many years ago now.
It was.
We were speaking to Ian Cheeseman from BBC Radio Manchester, formerly of BBC Radio Manchester, last week on the podcast, talking about the way that the local radio market had changed. And he brought up during that conversation the changes in local newspapers. And I know that you gave a rather heartfelt and rather well-received speech at the Sports Journalism Award ceremony earlier in the month when you won Regional Journalist of the Year, talking about the importance of local newspapers. Why do you think they're so important to football clubs?
It's a staple diet, isn't it? It's from covering Pompey, which obviously I've talked about in my speech. You yourself have been there. We've been at the low points, at the high points, and then plummeting down towards the bottom of League Two. And local papers are there covering it all. We're there to scrutinise, to question, to provide coverage. And how national media works is that it gets to a point and they will naturally stop covering football clubs. Because it's below their eyesight, if you like, below their vision.
And it goes out of the news cycle.
Yeah.
Something else comes along.
It's how it is. I'm not having a go at the national press. It's how it is. So, for example, the top papers in the country aren't interested in Accrington, who are 16th in League One, unless it's an FA Cup run and that sort of thing. So,
well, they're interested in Oldham at the moment because of Paul Scholes, but in 3-4 weeks' time, they might not be.
Exactly. And it's how it works. And the local paper is there to provide the coverage, simple as that, of those football clubs. And
to the supporters?
Yes. And we continue to play a massive role, especially these days when we're under pressure we're instructed through web hits to provide even more coverage. And it's just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
With less people, less resources, or more resources?
It's just difficult. Sports desks across the country are continually shrinking, so in that respect, less resources. And obviously, we're told to increase the coverage. So, for example, I remember looking at the paper 25 years ago. There'll be one Pompey story in the paper.
Yeah.
Sometimes the back page lead, and I always use an example, the back page lead will be a story on England v India in the cricket. A national story. That's 25 years ago. These days, obviously a big leap from then to now, but these days, we probably, through the internet, through the web, our website, do 12 stories a day.
On Portsmouth?
On Pompey
just
alone.
Just on one football club?
A day on one club.
Do you do it on once every single player every day?
Yeah, well...
Every single player has to have a story over a 24-hour period.
Exactly. And you have to... The only way to get through that is to do different types of stories. For example, on this day.
Yeah.
On this day. Very inoffensive. Sometimes it's quite interesting. Recently, we had it on this day with Sacha Guidemat took over the club. You know, that sort of thing on this day.
I remember that day.
Oh, yeah.
Martin Hopkins, who used to work with us, tried to find out where he lived in central London, went round his house... wrote a handwritten note and posted it through his letterbox saying, I work for a local radio station in Portsmouth, I'd like to talk to you.
Oh, left his number.
Never phoned him back. Right?
No. So these sort of things is part of the coverage, part of what the drive to get web hits. It's all about web hits these days.
Yeah.
We're under pressure to get web hits. Recently, my newspaper, the Portsmouth News, we are the guinea pigs for having individual journalists now given web targets every day, every month.
Wow.
So that's all changed very recently. At the moment, I think I'm just about, hopefully I'll keep the job long enough if I don't get it. But we have web hits as well. And we're piloting it in our company anyway.
Right, okay.
So this is the added pressure.
And where do you see the local coverage in 10 years' time? We've spoken about how in terms of radio and audio, a lot of the stuff has moved online. There's podcasts now that are devoted to clubs. Loads of podcasts devoted to loads of different clubs. Each club probably has got two or three, even going down into League One, I would have thought. But in your situation, do you worry that maybe over time, a bit like whereas local radio stations have been sort of replaced by local podcasts in areas, that maybe local papers will be replaced by local bloggers or fan sites?
The thing we have to focus on is being factually correct and putting the truth. And obviously Donald Trump's coined this fake news business, isn't it? Mm. We've got to prioritise being the source that gives people the truth. And obviously...
Fan sites can do that as well, right?
Yes, but you also get through social media, especially transfer window, fake news, made up transfer stories, for example. Mm. These wonderful... in the no agent accounts with shadowy faces that have mysteriously appeared that month, which so many people believe in nowadays.
Yeah, well, Alex Crook spends pretty much most of January doing
it
that.
It drives me mad because people believe what they say. And it's up to us to find out the truth, put out the true rumours. And it's very, very annoying that people believe anything on social media these days. Mm. There's another one is in the know newspaper reporters, and again it's but with no name. It's like, excuse me, if you were a newspaper journalist,
you
put rumours,
you
put your name on it. Defeats the objective, doesn't it? And these are the things we have to try to put people correct on and illustrate that we print the truth, we print accuracy. That has to be our buzzword, that's be our ambition, so people come to us first if they want to find out the truth.
Brilliant, thank you. Nice
there
to
you
see
go.
You again.
Yeah,
cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
I really enjoyed talking to Neil Allen ahead of what was a rather laboured Portsmouth Hall of Fame dinner that Crook and I both went to on Friday night, which was wonderful. Mainly because Owen Hand, who used to play for Portsmouth and the Republic of Ireland many moons ago, got up and gave the longest speech in history, which was in part absolutely hilarious and in part so cringy you didn't know where to look.
He started singing Danny Boy.
Oh, God.
The whole room just sort of shushed and then gave him an ovation. But I think to get him off.
Yeah, I think we stood up and just tried to just shuffle him off the stage. Yeah. Shall we get the result of the language of love?
Yes, please.
Oh, my God, an insane goal!
The language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Okay, so what are your guesses for Super Sub? Where did it come from? Or who did it come from?
I don't know. I mean, obviously it's just about a substitute who is amazing. And I've never thought more about it than that. You know, they've done brilliantly. They're a super sub like that.
So think of your. So think of who would have made the headlines then. Who, because substitutes weren't introduced till late. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. If you type the word super sub into Google, his face comes up.
Okay.
But it's not him.
It was only. Was it in the 80s when the subs were first introduced?
Nope.
Or earlier than that.
Earlier than that. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's just all I've ever thought about it. I didn't actually realise there was more to it.
Okay, so the phrase came about because Liverpool, who were winning everything in the 60s and 70s, had a super sub, and his name was David Fairclough.
Ah, do you know what? I know that.
However, I should have said that. The issue is, he's not a super sub. He scored 37 goals in 92 starts for Liverpool, which is a really good ratio, isn't it? 37 in 92. It's like almost one in, what, nearly one in two. Nearly. One in two and a bit. He got 18 goals in 62 substitute appearances. Now, because of the fact that he used to come on and rescue situations for Liverpool or play a part in goals, he was tagged with super sub. He hates it. He absolutely hates being called the original super sub. And the statistics bear out the fact that he didn't actually score that many goals as a substitute, and more were scored when he was starting games. So the origin of the word super sub comes from David Fairclough, but actually, he wasn't that super as a sub anyway.
I knew it might be to do with Fairclough, actually, with hindsight, but it's interesting. It's not one of your better ones, Sam, but it's interesting.
Sam, with all the love in the world, that's not one of your better ones.
Oh, God, right, okay.
I'm sorry, I just feel like what's the word I'm looking for?
I've given you
taken away from the meaning of super sub now.
I've given you the etymology of a word that we use in everyday football lexicon, and it comes from someone who wasn't what it said.
Yeah, it sort of spoils it.
Crikey. All right, you two are hard to please.
Back to the drawing board for next week. Well, that is sadly all we have time for this week. Our thanks to Guy Mowbray and Neil Allen, and to you guys at home for listening. And we will see you again next week.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.